Welcome to Journeys of Empowerment. I'm Michiel Soetjiet-Rijt, your host. This podcast is all about sparking agency, resilience, and finding the right role models, turning life's challenges into opportunities for growth and impact. Ready to unlock your potential? Let's dive in. But before we do that, a huge shout out to our amazing sponsor, Neotopia. Neotopia is the go-to agency for training, coaching, and certification in organizational behavior management. Their mission is to make the world a better workplace through positive reinforcement of desired behaviors. Thank you so much, Neotopia, for believing in journeys of empowerment and helping us spark agency in leaders everywhere. In today's second episode, I'm thrilled to introduce Karim El Otifi, a dynamic and purpose-driven founder of the Wheels of Impact. Karim is deeply committed to helping organizations attract and sustain diverse teams through integrated engagement strategies. His work focuses on tapping into the full potential of diverse talent through keynotes, workshops, and consultancy. From crafting innovative solutions to fostering transformation that lasts, Karim helps companies harness the unique voices within their teams to drive real, meaningful change. Karim's journey is particularly inspiring. Living in the intersection of being a person of color, disabled, neurodiverse, Arab, and Muslim, he brings a wealth of experience and insight to topics like diversity, equity, inclusion, and systemic change. His ability to make complex ideas like intersectionality and neurodiversity not only relatable, but actionable is truly remarkable. And I've personally been struck by Karim's unmatched resilience. Despite the challenges he's faced, he always bounces back with an energy and enthusiasm that is contagious. I can't wait for you to hear this story and the powerful insights he shares. Here we go. So Karim, welcome. What did you think about the whole introduction? Was it representative?
I think you really could not have done a better job. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, I don't need to tell you, Michiel, you've been with me on this journey from the very beginning. I think you were the first person I ever shared the concept for the Wheels of Impact with. And to see it sort of come full circle to today when we're sitting here and talking about it and talking about my journey, I'm just so happy. Happiest I've been in a long time. So thanks for that.
Well, I have to take a moment. Just seriously, to start a conversation in this way. Wow. So maybe good for the audience to elaborate on the Wheels of Impact. Share what you want to share.
Sure. So the Wheels of Impact is a boutique consultancy really focused on engagement, as you heard. So what do I mean by engagement? Engagement for me goes all the way from one meaningful conversation to an entire strategy for a 7,000-person organization, for example. We really operate at the intersection of DEI, systemic change, and communications. So we could go anywhere from storytelling to change strategy to general DEI direction to reviving ERGs to employer branding. Think of us as your sort of one-stop shop for anything that has to do with engaging your employees with how they work together, how they connect to one another, and with ideas related to diversity, identity, and how we can foster that to create ultimately innovation and a stronger bottom line. Clear?
Wow, very clear. And yeah, I should put something in the notes, what you just said, because it's like a sort of, how do you put that, name the thing where you put your jackets on? The jackets on, nah, it doesn't matter, but it sounds really great. And I think the world needs this. We're at a cross point in the world. There's so much conflict, so much distrust, so much, and we need this. We need this. And but can you elaborate, can you share us a little bit more about, for instance, intersectionality and your workshop? Because that really opened my mind and really opened my eyes.
So for those that don't know, we recently had an intersectionality entrepreneurship, a new workshop with the amazing people over at She Leads Plus and the Erasmus Center of Entrepreneurship. And in there, we really dove deep into the struggles faced by founders who carry so many layers of identity within them, so many layers of experience within them, and how that may impact them in a system that has historically favored a different type of founder or a different type of person. I mean, just want the audience for a second, if you close your eyes and think of the word founder, and I'm not talking to those of us that are founders or that are different, but rather just think, when the average person closes their eyes and thinks, okay, what is a founder? In my experience, 9 times out of 10, they're probably thinking of a man. 9 times out of 10, they're probably thinking of someone who's maybe able-bodied, etc. And I mean, this is all coming from things like bias training. For example, think of when you think of the word doctor, when you think of the word lawyer, when you think of the word nurse. Unless you have a personal example in your life that tells you different, we all have these different ideas of what different people look like and are. And that's basically what intersectionality is. Intersectionality talks about how your experience as a person, whether that be me being disabled, me being a person of color, me being neurodivergent, is different from someone who doesn't have that. And each person's experience is different because of the unique interplay of their identity factors.
And what is the role? Because for me, it was also new, and I'm really new in the world. You are so well educated in yourself experiencing, and so you also mentioned in the workshop positionality. Mm. How does that blend in?
So basically, positionality is a tool to understand intersectionality. So intersectionality really refers to how the world treats you because of the different layers that are within you of identity. While positionality is more about where you stand in the system in orientation with those that have traditionally been in power. So there's the wheel of power and privilege, which is an excellent tool to study positionality, where power is sort of in the middle and then there's layers. And the further you are at the end of the wheel, the further you are from the center of what is considered power, the more you are, in a way, disadvantaged in society systems, purely because they weren't built for you.
Mm. Wow. And how does the audience respond to this workshop? Do they understand it, or is the conversation started? What happens?
I think it really depends on the kind of audience you deal with. And in this particular workshop, we were extremely lucky to be surrounded by so much creative energy that you were able to sort of tap into people's heart. And I think something I've learned recently is that delivery and packaging things is so, so very important.
And what do you mean by packaging?
Well, let's take a simple example. I could just come out here and say, oh, the world is filled with straight white men that have historically made lots of money, and what I want to do is change that. What I want to do is flip it on its head because I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right. That's not how I communicate as a person, and that's not what I believe. But what I do believe is that historically, certain types of people have benefited from certain types of systems, and that we need to create opportunities for different kinds of people that maybe have not benefited in the system as far to sort of have the option. And a great example that I like to use is, just because you use the stairs doesn't mean we don't need an elevator. I mean, for me, that's very literal.
Yeah, that's what crossed my mind already, because I'm regularly traveling with you by train and public transport, right? And you saw what the first time happened. I was drained. traveling with you and seeing all the hurdles we had to find an elevator. And the elevator was already, of course, at the end of every station instead of in the middle where you get out of the train. And then, so that's sorry.
But see, you just mentioned a perfect example of what that means. That's very literal. You know, most people get out of the train, they go down the stairs, they don't think about it. I don't have that option. Most people go to an event and there's lots of high tables and then they don't even think about it. I don't have that option. And what I want to do is facilitate a world where everyone has options, where everyone has access, because we all deserve an opportunity to have our voice at the table. But you see how that perspective is different from what I said before? And that's really what I mean by the importance of framing and packaging. You know, sometimes you'll get much further by being more open to people and by not pointing fingers. And I think what I see a lot is a lot of justified anger based off of like the history of things that happen. And, you know, the workplace can be sometimes so dynamic, which makes it heavy on certain people. And so they have certain experiences that were difficult. So the anger, the pain is very justified. But ultimately, we don't get anywhere by burning bridges and dividing people. We don't get anywhere by working in silos. And I want to work with everybody and sort of hold their hand wherever they are in this journey and be like, hey, I'm here. I'm here to help. I'm here to give you the support that you need to also tap into what your system needs and support your people, because that'll make them work harder for you. That'll make them innovate better. That'll make them work more. And ultimately, it'll feed your bottom line. Like, let's not lie and say we don't all like to make money.
No, there's nothing wrong with making money, right?
No, not at all.
Not at all, not at all. And I'm really, I think the listener was really curious, okay, but what led you to come to this path and to start this journey and to explore and to package it and to start helping people? What led you to this path?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but if I really had to boil it down, it started for me in really trying to build something for the international community. So I started my work as an entrepreneur really focused on the international community and highlighting the voices of the international community. And I don't think I've ever like shared the story publicly before, but actually living in the Netherlands was the first time I had personally experienced a form of potential racism. Mm-hmm. I think it was on a company visit in my second year of university. I just came in to meet with the people. I was representing my group. And I said, hello, we're here for the company visit. Where should we get situated? And I just got ignored. I got barely looked at. And when the person sort of looked up, she was like, oh, you're speaking English to me. We don't speak in English here. We weren't ready to prepare a presentation in English for a program that has the title international. Like, it has the word international in the name.
Oh, man.
It literally starts with the word international. So I'm like, what were you expecting? And then you go into this big presentation room where myself and a few of my colleagues who maybe look a bit different were placed in the back on purpose. And I was like, what? Why am I in the back? And then it was sort of this quick 30-minute presentation, but they had sort of selected, I don't think it's even conscious, but what I do remember, obviously this was a while ago, but what I do remember is that they had sort of approached a few of my colleagues who looked very Dutch and spoke Dutch and sort of asked them to come aside while the rest of us were asked to like leave. Mm. And I was like, what? What? And I just, at first I couldn't process. I was in such shock physically. I was in such shock emotionally that I was like, why is this happening to me? What did I do wrong? And at the time I was still walking with my crutch, mind you. So I went down in their elevator, sat on their steps close to the ground and cried.
Yeah.
Because wow. I had never been pushed aside like that. I didn't think that would ever happen to me. You know, obviously, each country has different types of race relations or whatever, and there were lots of experiences. In Egypt, we really have this, maybe leftover from colonization, we have this Western Western is best mentality. So we're really taught that, like, yo, you're going to move to the West, that your life is going to be so great, and, you know, to be as white as possible, almost. To be as digestible as possible to European and American audiences. So the fact that I had spent my entire life idolizing that, mastering my education, mastering my accent, mastering the kind of person you'd quote-unquote want me to be in the places I'm in right now.
Or at least you think people want you to be in the place you're at the moment, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, it took me years to unlearn that and to just learn to be myself. But at that time, having been here a year and a half, it's like my whole world came crashing down. But then the entrepreneur in me sort of started, and there was this sense of fire of like, okay, I'm going to tell them our story. I'm going to show them, you know? And at the time, I didn't have the vocabulary to say, I want to work in change. I want to work in diversity and inclusion. What did I know, you know? But luckily, I had an amazing team of people around me. I had a great environment, and we did that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Then we moved on to a more traditional sort of, let's support internationals trying to move to the Netherlands. But all along, there was this sort of itching. Like, why am I so bothered? Something's wrong. Something feels wrong, but I don't know what it is. So ultimately, I think it was now almost 2.5 years ago, I decided to take a break. Went to a program that I came across very randomly in a hotel lobby on a random Thursday. I met someone who is doing systemic change and is an expert in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like, I have a program starting in a couple of weeks.
Was this the same person you mentioned in your posting today?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Ah, very good. So about systemic change?
Yeah.
And her name you mentioned in the comments, right?
Yeah, Patricia van Overstotten.
Ah, okay.
She's an exceptional lady. And we met randomly at a bar in an evening at a hotel. And we had like this 3-hour conversation that was about entrepreneurship. That was about our journey. And you know, this was really one of those moments that was like, I'm clicking for you, you know? Like it's sometimes the universe puts people in your path and you don't know where they come from. It was really one of those moments because it was like really super random. I don't even remember exactly where it was anymore. But it changed my life. Mm. It became the baseline of everything I do today.
Beautiful, beautiful. It sounds like that the situation planted a seed.
Yeah.
And led you to meet a role model who helped you figure out starting to find language to express how that made you feel and how you probably can help a lot of people coping, or does it? Am I putting it in the right way?
I think you're putting it in the exact right way. It helped me find vocabulary and find empowerment in things I already understood about people and was already doing in my work as a community builder. As a facilitator for different types of things, you know.
And as you being you, because that's the way I met you is it's people first, it's human, it's connection, it's deep connection, and then the rest. And so for me, it's very logical because I know you. I don't know you in a different way than you being so open and so vulnerable and also sharing a lot of your struggles that helps a lot of people.
I think what's beautiful is that I wasn't always that way. I didn't always behave that way. And now I can't imagine being anything else.
Mm, I can't imagine either, because in the end of the day, if that's what we're feeling, and also the aim of this podcast, it really hit the nerve of the aim of this podcast, to spark agency in each and every one of us. It sounds, of course, like a very articulated slogan and to spark agency in each and every one of us. But if you peel the onion, for me, the real meaning of agency is that inner power we have, and we start limiting almost from the moment we are born. So we are born limitless, and each and every day we will add some layer of limits growing up. And then all of a sudden we are buried under all the limitations and beliefs. And then where are we? Where are we? Also on stage, if we are going to pitch founders, beautiful founders, on paths like you, on social, for social impact. And then we are going to pitch, and then all of a sudden you see it happening. It's like we put on a persona because we think that the world thinks about pitching in a certain way, and then we start acting in a certain way, and almost, I always lose the why. So the real intrinsic motivation, what is your inner spark? What is your...
But I think that has a lot to do with what our education system has taught us to do, right?
I don't know.
We've become very standardized. You're taught to follow the rules. You're taught to get the right grade. It's very rare to see pure critical thinking anymore. Because ultimately, education has become a business in different ways. Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking about international schools, whether we're talking about top-ranking universities, we're all chasing ranks and we're all chasing budgets. And I can say that because I worked at the university. And don't get me wrong, there are wonderful educators doing amazing things. And despite the limitations they have, they're still managing to inspire their students. They're still managing to create meaningful change. But that's really on a, you know, we talk about a world of systems and layers, that's on the individual level mm-hmm. and the direct community level. But ultimately, if we look at the entirety of strategy in terms of where direction of education is going, we're leaning on tech. We're leaning on really, you know, more measurability, more direction, and no one wants to take a risk. And I don't think when it comes to educating people and allowing them to reflect on who they are, risk is something we should push away.
What do you mean with risk in the context of what you're just saying? Which kind of risk for who?
But like, let's get into the mind of a pitching founder, right? They're probably pitching for funding. They're probably pitching for support of some kind. They need to seem as the least level of risk possible for the person that's going to invest in them, right? They need to convince that person that they are worth betting on. But if you follow what traditional programs tell you to do, you're going to look at how your income is going to grow. You're going to look at how your company is going to grow. You're going to show all these graphs, right? You're going to show how, oh, I'm going to make this money in this amount of time. You just need to give me this money because I need to secure your investment, but I need to make you feel like your investment is almost risk-free. You're taught to minimize risk as much as you can. But what happens when that happens is that the human element gets ignored. Because you're trying to package something so heavily into an idea that you think is going to convince the person in front of you that you lose who you are.
That's what we regularly are talking about, right? When we see pitches in front of us.
Yeah.
You and me together. Like, what's happening? What's happening here?
It's become so, it's almost formulaic.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but me and the people around me and the people that I know, and by you I mean the listener, because I know about you, Michiel. But I don't know about you, but the people around me, the community around me, would much rather bet on a founder who tells us his story and knows what he wants to do and is trying to grow and is vulnerable enough to say, okay, I need help. I need to build. And obviously there's a business case there. I'm not saying show up to a pitch without a business case. But I don't want to put my money, my time, my faith in someone that I don't know, that I don't believe in. And I'm sorry, but I'm not the kind of person who believes in a graph. I believe in a person.
People don't buy from people buy from people, right? So, and it's a matter of, people don't buy what you do. People don't buy why you do it. And this is exactly what I mean. But and to stay one step back, an interesting thing you mentioned is that there is a difference between what we as audience expect, and at the same time, when out of the audience somebody stands up, gets on the stage, there is a mind shift change, and then all of a sudden, the mindset is changing, I have to act in a sort of way, and it differs from the whole group in the whole environment at that moment, at the event, right?
Yeah.
Why does that happen?
I think it's very human. Mm. We're all afraid to disappoint other people. But what I've had to learn, and I think I gave this advice multiple times today. Actually, not today, this week. Be scared. Do it anyway. That's my secret.
It resonates. May I share an honest, brutally honest story?
Please.
When I got this beautiful equipment from a good friend, it also put a sort of... The message was, no pressure, buddy. But hey, if somebody gives you this gear, of course, something is going to change. You know, it does something to you. The moment I unpacked it, I was in awe. The beauty of the whole equipment. The moment I pulled all the plugs in and the power supply and the headphone on my head, hearing my own voice through the microphone, and knew that, okay, Michiel, you've been a few times, multiple times, a guest, but now you're going to be a host. This is a total different ballgame. And all of a sudden, for me, I cringed. So when I'm normally, I can articulate quite well, right? And but now I decided, because 40% of my network is international, so I thought, yeah, Michiel, you are all about inclusion, so start right away in English. And then I was like, oh, but English, and hear yourself, and you're not good enough, and anxiety crept in. And so what I did, embrace the discomfort. So the first 2 days, I was really in the procrastination mode. I was like, okay, I'm not good enough. Maybe I start in Dutch, and then maybe later on switch. And then I started recording an audiobook, and 10 minutes every morning, 10 minutes every night, still doing that for already 60 days, and also listening it back and pushing yourself to hear yourself back 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening does something with you. But the beauty of it, due to do it consistently, it pushed me through all my anxiety and boundaries. So I hope for the listener, I'm followable. So I'm pretty okay in making myself understandable, and I will keep practicing. But for me, I'm sitting here much more relaxed, and that's maybe what we can give as a sort of advice also to practice. Do you think a lot of founders are practicing enough
in their pitches? I think founders, no one gives enough credit to founders.
No.
Founders are working their ass off. They need to handle marketing, sales, operations, finance, things that in other companies have people for, or even big departments for. Mm. And plus, if they're the originating founder, we kind of expect them to be the face of it. We kind of expect them to build a brand. We expect them to be great storytellers. We've gotten so used to the unicorns that we're all on the hunt for the next unicorn. And we lack our vision to see potential. Mm. So all I have to say is that if you really want to pitch, practice in front of a mirror a couple of times. Maybe do it once every week, once every couple of weeks. I don't know how often you pitch, but if you pitch often, I would do it more. But try to get used to talking to yourself at least. Mm. Because that's usually what happens when you panic before getting on a stage, is usually this sort of process in your brain where you're imagining yourself failing.
That's spot on. That's spot on. That's why I cringed. So that's spot on. Thank you very much. On behalf of the audience, I hope so. It's for sure from my side, because that was really... And the other thing was, and he said, and I was not very happy when he said it, Michiel, normally in big audiences, you don't care. You always are very relaxed and spontaneous. I don't know. Doesn't matter. And very relaxed and very... but there you can see your audience and you can see their mimics and you see their face and expression, and yeah, you are out of control because here you don't see anybody. Yeah, in the conversation, actual conversation, I'm lucky to see you, Kareem, today. But yeah, you have no control at all. So that makes it also a little challenging and special. But okay.
If I may share something really vulnerable now. And I'm trusting you and I'm trusting our lovely audience to carry this with us. What scares me isn't this giant group of people. What scares me most is this one-on-one, two-on-one. A lot of people are surprised to hear that because they're like, you're the most friendly and sociable person I know. But I grew up with a voice in my head telling me I'm too much. Telling me that I can overwhelm people. And a lot of people don't realize that every time I talk to them, there's this voice at the back of my head telling me, oh, you didn't do enough. Oh, you didn't try hard enough. Oh, you couldn't get that client because you suck. People don't like you enough. Oh, this person's now upset with you because you said this wrong word. Could be that, I don't know, a slip of the tongue, I called them a different name. Or I phrased something differently than I thought I should. Or something as simple as just got too quiet or spoke too much. Or a lot of people don't realize that there's this whole system going on in my brain every time I talk to someone. And the good thing about being on stage for someone like me is that I just let my mind go. Mm-hmm. Because all I care about is it's one unified story for a giant group of people. While my personal people-pleasing tendencies make me want to give you as much as I can when you're an individual person, that it overwhelms my system. And I still remember the first time I shared this with a friend, they looked at me and were like, but you're the most sociable person I know. And I'm like, that's precisely why. I go back to what I said earlier. Be scared. Do it anyway. It's what I do.
Yeah. I admire you for that. There are a lot of situations where we were together and where I see it was obvious that you were sort of anxious or scared. And yes, you did it anyway. So you are a very great example, leading by example when it comes to... in the introduction, there are so many sections of you. One is also neurodiversity. And I know we only have 1 hour or whatever for this conversation, and we will scratch some topics, and for sure in future we will deep dive even more into maybe what the audience would feedbacking about hearing more about. But neurodiversity, for me, 2 years ago I didn't know anything about it. I can imagine it's relatively new for quite some people. So can you, in your way, explain neurodiversity?
Okay. First of all, I want to make sure that we know the distinction between neurodiversity and neurodivergence. Because a neurodiversity is something we all have, in the sense that all of our brains work a little differently. While a neurodivergence is one of the conditions you might traditionally associate with this idea, like being... I don't know, having ADHD, having autism, having dyslexia. Some mental health conditions are considered form of neurodivergence. Like, my point is there's a difference between really communicating about having a different brain and that your brain works differently. So neurodiversity is this giant umbrella of all our brains work differently, while neurodivergence is a subset of brains that work so differently from, quote-unquote, the average that we've labeled it as a type of condition. Now, I'm one of those people who leans on the side of this is a superpower, because I can only speak for my own brain, of course, and I have cerebral palsy.
Sorry?
Cerebral palsy. I don't know if you know much about it. Basically, it's a...
All right, yeah, can you first elaborate on that? Because that's...
Sure.
Yeah.
Without losing
where it came from. Eh? So the
no,
without
no, losing. No, okay, we'll okay, get there. We'll get back there. So yeah, I mentioned the very like popular conditions we associate with neurodivergence, right? Whether it's autism, whether it's ADHD, whether it's dyslexia, dyscalculia, different types of mental health. But what I didn't know until a couple of years ago, which what I didn't know until a couple of years ago was that cerebral palsy,
yeah,
which is also my physical condition, my disability, is a form of neurodivergence. Because the key is that it's something that happens in your brain. It's some form of chemical imbalance. It's some sort of traumatic thing that happened in your brain that made your brain work differently. And it's usually connected to your biology, your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when I was born, I had a hypoxia, which is basically lack of oxygen to the brain. And I believe for me that was about 3 seconds. Mm. And it's funny how 3 seconds not getting to the oxygen not getting to the right place in your brain at the exact right time can do to you. You know, my walking isn't great. My hand-eye coordination isn't great. It would be pretty risky for me to drive, for example. Mm. My fine motor skills aren't great, so my handwriting isn't great. It's also very hard for me to do very detail-oriented work, which is why I prefer to do big picture work. And a lot of people will say, you know, when they really want detailed work, I'll always say, oh, this isn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, it's not because I'm trying to be an arrogant asshole. It's because I genuinely know that biologically this is very heavy on my brain. And I'm lucky now to have a team of people that are detail oriented, that are able to, you know, that are able to supplement my skills and my deficits.
Why do you think, why do you think people think that you're arrogant? What makes you think that people might think that?
I've heard it. People aren't shy with telling you what they think about you. And I've had people tell me that I need to be realistic, that I shouldn't dream, that I shouldn't want too much, that I shouldn't want the clients that I have, that I shouldn't want to build this career. You know, there's this mentality, partly because I'm an international, partly because I speak English, partly because I'm disabled. All of that compounds together, and that goes back to the point about intersectionality, right? To make people believe I can't do something. And some of them might even be well-meaning. Some of them are my friends. I know they don't mean to. But there's always this, be realistic, Kareem. Don't dream too hard. Don't push too far.
Partly in our own head, partly in others? Or is it only in other heads? Is it partly, partly?
I think the day I start believing it is the day I've died.
Mm.
And I don't mean physically died. I think the minute my creativity dies, the minute I start seeing boundaries and not opportunities,
mm-hmm.
I'm dead. The minute I stop being an entrepreneur, the minute I stop creating, like, if you ever see me taking on a full-time desk job, giving up on entrepreneurship entirely, that's when you know something really hit me. And don't get me wrong, I've come close. I've come so close so many times. Because people break you. And I'm someone, I wish I didn't care about people's opinions or people's voices. But I grew up in a culture that taught me to care so much that eventually enough people tell you to not do this, tell you you're crazy, and you start believing something's wrong with you. You start believing you're broken. Yet somehow, and this is maybe the part of me that's a bit more fiery and spicy, every time I do something like this, something spicy comes out in one way or another. Somehow.
It was already clear in the preparations, right? Setting up shop.
Sort of gone. But somehow this person who isn't supposed to be doing this work, who isn't supposed to dream this far, managed to get Erasmus University, Tech Leap, Trivium Packaging, UN Global Compact, She Leads Plus, all kinds of not just small, really social-driven initiatives, but all kinds of giant organizations we all know and love, right?
Mm-hmm.
to work with me, to believe in what I do. So that's what I say now. You know, you think I can't do this? Look at all the people that think I can. And I know on the one hand, that's also another form of people pleasing. I should believe in myself. And don't get me wrong, I do. And I'm a fighter. Mm-hmm. I think anyone who knows me knows that about me. But now I'm like, okay, why should I care what you think? Like, look at all these people that have actually wanted to pay me to do my job.
And to circle a little bit back to the neurodiversity, because we can go wide very rapidly, and also, but to tie to the neurodiversity, what do we need the world to understand about neurodiversity?
Harness its power. My brain works crazy fast. I think you once called me human ChatGPT.
Yeah, I did.
And I'll never
wheels.
Forget that.
On wheels.
Human ChatGPT
on wheels.
I see relationships and connections between things super quickly.
Yeah.
I'm a very fast conceptor. And if you ever had, I assume people listening here have, some of them have had a conversation with me before and know what that's like. You know, you drop a seed of something and suddenly my brain's made all these connections. That's a superpower. And every single person I know with a form of neurodivergence has some kind of superpower. I don't know what it is. Some people are very visual thinkers. Some people are great organizers. Learn who the people in your team are. Learn what their strong suits are. Put them in the right position and watch them flourish.
Hear, 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 hear. Put your hands up in the air. Make some noise for the one and only Kareem. You're right, buddy. But, okay. Do you believe in neurotypical at all?
I do think while we all have a form of neurodiversity and our brains work differently in minor pieces, I understand why the term neurotypical exists. Because we've pushed neurodivergence so far into a corner that it needs a balance on the other side. And I think there are levels of it, right? There are things we accept as quirks. There are things we accept, oh, this person's just a little weird. This person's just a little funny, you know? And that's why this distinction matters to people. That there are differences that we accept and differences that we don't.
It's all about acceptance at the end.
Yeah, and I mean, not to get too political, but I think the Netherlands brands itself as the most tolerant country on the planet. That's the key word here, tolerant. Tolerance is not acceptance. Tolerance is not inclusion.
Can you explain a little bit more what you think in your view, what the difference is between tolerance and acceptance?
I mean, just again, taking, this isn't to single out any particular culture or mm-hmm. anything, but this is where I live, so I'm going to use that as an example because I assume a lot of people that are listening to this also live here. Do normal, right? We have this what is normal type of label and culture.
Ik wil dat niet.
Ik wil dat niet, exactly. He makes fun of me for that sentence because I say that a lot.
Ik wil dat niet. I always have to laugh when you say that. Ik wil dat niet, sorry. But do normal.
Yeah. Do normal, I think it's do normal, normal is heel genoeg, no?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. There's such a normalcy or idea of normalcy within the culture that whatever is outside of that is tolerated. Because also, if we look at the history of trade and trade relations and the kind of relationship this country has had with other countries, we can really see that there is benefit from connecting to the outside world. And that's where I think this sort of came from, right? This whole, we are normal according to us, but we need to accept everyone else so we can do business, so we can innovate, so we can create together. We can't make them the enemy. We can't not like them. So we accept that they're here. And it's the same, you know, I felt it as an international student. I felt it as as someone who did work in different kinds of organizations. I still feel it every day. We accept that you're here, but God help us if we actually open a door for you, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, to me, the difference. I don't just accept that you exist. I want to help you. And the more different you are, the more pressure you face, the more I want to uplift you. But that's also because I grew up in international schools and this cosmopolitan world bubble. I was surrounded by so much difference my entire life that it became normal for me.
But is that a why? Is that a why? I think it's deeper. It multiplied it. But there is a reason why this specifically helping people in this area. Why is this so important for you? What does it answer inside of yourself?
I grew up in not the healthiest environment. I grew up between two parents that are so different from one another, so opposing. I grew up with a mother who taught me to shine, who taught me I could be anything, who nurtured my love for music and the arts, and my sense of joy, the smile that people love so much about me. All of that comes from my mom, who I love so dearly and made sure I felt I had a place in this world. It is unfortunate to say that both my parents weren't like that. I'll still have a father. He's not dead. Let's not pretend he is. But my father was a very stern man. He was a very traditional man. And that has a lot to do with the culture he grew up in and the environments, you know, the pressures faced by men in the culture I come from. A lot more conservative, a lot more fearful as an individual. And his way of mitigating that was to make me feel like nothing I ever did was good enough. That I will never be good enough. That I need to push harder and harder and harder. And I cracked under the pressure. Because now there's two voices in my head. There's two ideas. And, you know, that's, I think you talk a lot about mental health books, right? The Body Keeps the Score, for example. Who's the author of that again?
Bessel van der Kolk.
Yeah, wasn't sure.
Yeah.
But there are two voices in my head. There's that voice that we talked about earlier of, okay, you know what? All these people hired me to do this thing. I push through. I see opportunity. Be brave, do it anyway. And that comes from the way my mother raised me. To believe, to have the audacity to believe I belonged anywhere and I could do anything. And then there's the voice in me that I talked about earlier with the constant panic of, okay, what do people think of me? What did I say wrong? What did I do wrong? Why I'm so wrong all the time. That comes from the way my father raised me. And that has created this inner tension in me to want to build the world that my mother raised me to see. Because that's what I want to do. And maybe this is too ambitious. Maybe I'm crazy. And let me be crazy. But I want to change the world so that every little boy like me can feel safe, can feel loved, can feel valued, and parents don't have to be scared to raise their disabled boys to change the world.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I have to let to say, sink that in, because this is so much. Thank you for sharing.
Of course.
What listeners don't know is that we always do, I just started my podcast, hear me now, do always, but start with a pre-conversation in which I always also ask if there are some specific boundaries or areas in some part of your life and history and journey which you rather prefer to stay out of, and what if it happens spontaneously, what sign do we give each other? And but you were so open already and all by so much vulnerable situations, and there aren't any boundaries. And I'm so happy that you share this. I hope it will help a lot of listeners who are out there listening to this. And struggling through life and navigating through all the obligations, expectations, opinions we're living in. And hear this voice of you, so open about the little voice in your head.
I think if I were to leave a drop of advice to the people listening,
please do so.
Tap into the voice in your head that's you as a younger child, you know, that carefreeness, that joie de vivre, that sense of freedom.
Joie de vivre.
Mm-hmm. My God. Also, I speak French in case people didn't know.
Je sais. Tu parles un petit peu français, hein?
Non, je parle pas un petit peu, mais...
Oh, ouais. Oh, ouais. Okay, but let's get back. Let's
yeah, let's, for our non-French speaking audience, let's keep this section limited. But I think we're all better off listening to the little boy in us, or little girl in us, or little person in us, for those of us that are non-binary, that dreamed and believed. Because if we all acted on our dreams and all acted on our beliefs, the world would be such a better place. And I mean, don't worry, like, don't get me wrong, some of our beliefs are really twisted in a way. Like, a lot of humanity has struggled with certain ideas, but I believe there's a dreamer in all of us. And if you tap into that dreamer, let it guide your heart, you're gonna build amazing things.
Wow. I think this is a powerful message, buddy. Thank you very much for sharing, for your openness, for your vulnerability. Can people reach out to you?
Yes, I am always happy when someone reaches out to me. I think I am pretty visible, so a quick Google will make it very easy to find me. Most people can reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Yeah. Okay.
And my email is also publicly available, so if you email something you like, yeah, you can find me there. Not that hard to find.
So am I allowed to share something in the notes, like also your company address, and then people can reach out with questions? And I can imagine. I can imagine. This is also why we're here, right?
Yeah.
To share. And even though I think we're nearing the end of this episode, but I think we need more time with you. The world needs more time with you. And so we will come back, and we will go deeper into the conversations. We now touch upon neurodiversity, intersectionality, positionality, but there is so much more, right? There is so much more. A little bit about culture, cultural differences. It's all these sections what makes you a beautiful person. So thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that so open for us. And if you have, I think you did in your words, I still have one question which I would love to ask. And it is, Karim, imagine yourself sitting here in about 3 years, what would you love to be most proud of at that moment?
What I would love to be most proud of is the change I inspired in different spaces, in policy, in education, in organizations. I would love to see us really get a massive action plan on how to actually include people. I would love to see more and more organizations open their doors to talent like me, because I still don't see enough of it, particularly on the disabled layer. And I would love to continue educating, not just as a speaker and as a facilitator, but maybe even within an institution, maybe even as a teacher. Because believe it or not, I love to teach.
Yeah, we know. We know, and you're good at it. So thank you very much. And for the listeners, stay tuned. We will reveal the next candidate within a few seconds. But for now, Karim, thank you so much for you being you on this first conversational episode. One word close. If you have to say close in one word, what would that word be?
Empowerment.
Love the word, of course. Love.
I swear this was not staged.
No, it wasn't at all. Because I'm really sitting here. That's the interesting part. I'm really sitting here with all the preparations. No laptop open and with a Moleskine book. And what's the color?
Pink, bright pink. One of my favorites.
Pink, yeah. And with all the notes in it and of our pre-conversational notes. And I looked once or twice and just let the conversation flow. So to the listeners, I hope you've enjoyed it as much as Karim and I did, because this is really what Journeys of Empowerment is all about. It's maybe less structured. It's more about who we are as a person in total. And with all the fun and the messiness and the naughtiness and the vulnerability and all the sections we are feeling that we are part of. And so thank you for listening. Thank you for your valuable time. And on to the next one. Karim, last word for you.
Remember to love each other, people.